Welcome to St. Louis on the Air. America's involvement in Afghanistan is coming to an end. No mission accomplished banner here after more than a decade of fighting in the place that is said where empires go to die. Much has been written about our involvement, what we've done right and what we've done wrong. Our guest on today's program joins us to talk about one particular well-intended social science policy that fell far short of the mark because she says it was flawed. It was designed to see Afghanistan through the eyes of anthropologists who could help the military understand the culture and society in the nation in which it was fighting. Journalist author Vanessa Ghazari tells the story in her book, The Tender Soldier, A True Story of War and Sacrifice. It's been called A Tale of Good Intentions Gone Awry. Vanessa Ghazari is also the James Madison Visiting Professor at Columbia University's School of Journalism, and she is in town for a presentation tonight at the St. Louis County Library. She joins me in studio. Vanessa, so nice to see you.
Thank you so much for having me.
I enjoyed your book, and as I said just before you went on the air, it really made me mad. Our policy in Afghanistan and this particular program, it just really burned me up. We spent $600 million on this policy. And it made you mad, too.
It did, you know, and I was really glad to hear you say that. I think there have been many policy mistakes that we've made in Afghanistan over the last more than a decade since we went in there. And this is just the story of one little program that, as you so eloquently put it, it was a very well-intended effort to make soldiers smarter about a place like Afghanistan, which is extremely complicated. I mean, I've been reporting there on and off since 2002. And, you know, I don't at all consider myself to be an expert on the place. But what I can tell you is that what you see is not always what you get. And, you know, also that first impressions count for a lot. And we didn't make the best one with the Afghans.
And in many ways, it's still not making a good impression in that part of the world overall. I'm thinking of the drones, for instance.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, you know, that's right. The drones are a great example of the opposite kind of policy from the program that I write about in the book, which, you know, that the program that this book focuses on, it was about getting down with Afghans and helping to get to know them better, understand what's really going on with their world. Drones, you know, so attractive because we can fight from a distance. And that way we think that there's little risk to soldiers, which is true on the face of it. But, you know, drones can't tell the difference between a friend and an enemy.
Right. And every friend that is killed creates more enemies.
Absolutely right.
Yeah. What drew you into this particular project? What did you see and what did you learn that caused you to write this book?
So as I mentioned, you know, I've been reporting in Afghanistan since I was a young freelancer. First went over to that region actually on September 10th, 2001. So on just right on the eve of the attacks, and got involved in covering a war that I didn't expect to be right in the middle of. And during that time, you know, the first few years I was in the country writing for the Chicago Tribune, I spent some time with soldiers. And these are young guys, 19, 20, 21 years old. And, you know, infantrymen in our army are trained to fight and to kill. They're not trained to, you know, make deals with village elders. They're not trained to do politics or nation building. And yet that's exactly what they found themselves having to do pretty quickly after we got there. And not just that, but, you know, they had to figure out who really the bad guys were. And that's not an easy question in Afghanistan. I mean, you know, not all Afghans are bad guys. There's good guys, bad guys, mediocre guys, just much like here in the United States. So what I noticed was that soldiers really weren't in a position to make these decisions, and yet they were making these decisions. They were making policy for us on the ground. You know, fast forward a number of years, I went back when this program rolled out, which was in 2007, and I started to get very interested in this initiative that the Army had come up with to try to solve this problem.
This is the human terrain system.
Right. This is a program that, you know, it started in 07, as I mentioned, and the idea was to send civilian social scientists out into combat with soldiers to help them understand people in both Iraq and Afghanistan. So, yes, I was excited about it. A lot of people were excited about it. I mean, General David Petraeus, at that time the head of Central Command, was excited about it. And, you know, I guess what I wanted to do was follow this program and see how it actually played out. And the results, as you mentioned, were not great.
one of the things that bothered me is the name of the program, Human Terrain, referring to people. I don't know why we can't call people people instead of giving them names like Human Terrain.
Yeah, that's a great point. And, you know, the Army comes up with lots of names for things that regular people find odd, this one in particular. And there's been quite a lot of talk about why the name, where that name comes from and how it developed. I mean, one way to think about that, and it's important in terms of understanding the real goals of this program, is that when soldiers talk about intelligence, one of the things they look at weather, they look at terrain, they want to know where the hills are, where the valleys are, where you're going to be fighting. And, you know, this is really an intelligence effort to try to find out who these people are, so that the name actually gets you to something important about what the program is really all about.
Let's talk about the three people that really take us into the story and come back to a greater or lesser degree throughout the book. Tell us who they are and what they were doing there at that particular time. We're talking about 2008, Election Day in the United States.
Right. So November of 2008, November 4th, it just so happened that there was one of these human terrain teams in southern Afghanistan in a pretty rough, contested part of the country, and one that American soldiers hadn't paid a lot of attention to. So the American Army unit that was there was very new to that area. They were trying to understand it, and this team was there to help them understand it. So on that day, these three very idealistic and pretty well-trained American civilians were out with a group of soldiers. They were Paula Lloyd, who was has a degree from Wellesley in anthropology and a master's from Georgetown. She had spent years, she had been a soldier in Afghanistan, which is a very unlikely path for a Wellesley grad, and then spent years as a development worker there. Her teammates, one was a former bodyguard for Afghan President Hamid Karzai, who had been in Afghanistan right after the invasion and knew the country fairly well. And the other one had actually worked as an interrogator, you know, actually interrogating insurgents and Taliban suspects in Kandahar at the beginning of the war. So these individuals had, they brought a range of experience to the table. They understood the war from different perspectives. And they were out that day in this market interviewing Afghans, trying to find out how the local economy worked. They wanted to know what people were paying for things they bought in the market, you know, as a way of just getting the lay of the land and helping soldiers understand the place. And Paula Lloyd, who was the chief social scientist on the team, was interviewing an Afghan man who had bought some fuel, a jug of fuel, in the market. And at a certain point, suddenly, you know, about a half hour into their conversation, he threw the gasoline on her and lit her on fire. It was a terrible attack. And she was badly wounded. And the story follows the team from there. What happened next was arguably even more shocking, or just as shocking. And the story kind of unfolds.
Right. We don't want to spoil it for people because there is a suspense. One of the reviewers called it a moral suspense story, and that's exactly what it is. You mentioned General Petraeus. This concept, again, the name that I don't like very much, the Human Terrain Project, was really the brainchild of General Petraeus.
You know, in a way it was, but I think it's probably more correct to say that he supported it at a critical time. Mm-hmm. It was developed kind of by various people within the Pentagon from different corners of the Pentagon. There was senior science advisor at the Pentagon who worked on it. There was an anthropologist who worked on it, who was kind of also a war theorist, a woman who was very interested in the overlap between anthropology and intelligence. There was a former Army Ranger who was very frustrated by the mistakes the Army was making in Iraq and Afghanistan. These are fascinating characters. But I think Petraeus's role was more to be a kind of godfather. That is, you know, he had so much power. We might forget that now because of what's happened since. And this whole theory that he helped to, you know, raise awareness about and enact in Iraq, the counterinsurgency theory that had, you know, really vanished in a lot of ways from military practice for the last 30 years. I mean, since Vietnam, he really helped bring that back. And when he, you know, when Petraeus would say something like, you know, this is a program worth supporting, or when he would use terms in his speeches like human terrain, the human terrain is what we need to understand. then, you know, people paid attention. And so the program gained a lot of currency because of that.
Yeah, I have a quote from the book here that I found most interesting, that this program was called a politically liberal fringe movement within the U.S. Army. That doesn't bode well in and of itself, it seems to me. There's a certain amount of conflict there.
Yeah, you know, that was really my take on it when I first started hanging out with these people. It was almost as if, you know, to be clear, you know, this is a program that came into being under the Bush administration. So it's not something that it wasn't like under a Democratic administration. It wasn't a progressive program. But I think the people who created it and developed it saw themselves as progressives within the context of really a very hidebound military, a military that, you know, talks in acronyms and you know, thinks like engineers a lot of the time and doesn't really see people for people, a military that comes up with terms like human terrain. And so that's what I meant by that.
Yeah. We have to take a break in just a moment. Tell me a little bit more about the anthropologist's reaction to this program. I know that it varied and it evolved as well.
Yeah, and it's also complicated. But the uncomplicated thing is that initially when this program rolled out in 2007, most anthropologists were furious. And indeed, the American Anthropological Association, which is the largest professional group of anthropologists in the United States, it has about 11,000 members, came out very strongly against the program, saying that, you know, never should anthropological knowledge be used in the furtherance of a war or of America's imperialist goals. Now, you know, over time, I think some anthropologists, even critical ones, came to speak in more measured tones about the whole idea of using anthropology in war. But the objection to the program and the way the program was set up from anthropologists has never gone away for very particular reasons. I mean, anthropologists have, you know, they have a code of ethics, and part of that has to do with not ever harming the people who they're studying or they're interviewing. And, you know, obviously if you're with the military, you're wearing a uniform, you're carrying a gun, which many of these field team members did in Afghanistan, not Paula Lloyd, but many others. And you're out there asking questions, you know, the chances that somebody you're talking to is going to turn out to not have the greatest views about the U.S. military are pretty high. And that person could come under fire because of an interview, because of questions that you asked on behalf of the military, puts anthropologists in a very, really an untenable situation.
Plus the notion that they might be gathering true military intelligence was in itself a dangerous thing.
Absolutely. And that's something that anthropologists really object to for the most part.
Have to take a break. We'll do that now. I'm talking with journalist author Vanessa Ghazari. Her book, The Tender Soldier, A True Story of War and Sacrifice. We'll come back and continue our discussion in just a moment. I'd like to bring you into it, as we always do. 382-8255 is the number. That's 382-TALK. You can also send us an email at talk@stlpublicradio.org, and we'll take a tweet at STL on air. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again and welcome back. We will continue our conversation with Vanessa Ghazari. She's the author of the book, The Tender Soldier, A True Story of War and Sacrifice. But before we continue, here are some of the stories our St. Louis Public Radio newsroom is following today. A Missouri Senate interim committee heard from health care providers this morning. The committee is exploring possible ways to alter Medicaid. Missouri House Speaker Tim Jones is asking the Attorney General for a legal opinion on whether a bill the governor vetoed regarding a tax on those who use prescription drugs would result in a retroactive tax, as the governor claims. Join St. Louis Public Radio this afternoon for local and regional news and throughout the day on our website at stlpublicradio.org. Now back to Vanessa Ghazari. How did the soldiers and Marines and whoever, our military people, how did they react to these teams that were coming in?
You know, there was a mixed reaction. I think a lot of young soldiers and Marines felt pretty grateful to have somebody there with them who understood the place a little better than they did. I would caveat that by saying that some of these team members who were sent out as cultural experts didn't know anything more about Afghanistan than the soldiers did. So, you know, in some cases, and this was a concern for people in the program, some of them, in some cases, the soldiers thought that they had a capability that they really didn't have. That is, they had been told, well, we're going to give you PhD level expertise on Afghanistan. And what they got was somebody who'd never been to Afghanistan, just much like them. You know, there are other soldiers and Marines and you know, just to speak to the Army, because it's clearer there, there's a debate within the Army about whether we should care at all about cultural knowledge and cultural intelligence, or whether we should even practice this counterinsurgency, nation building, you know, these kinds of missions with our military. Between people who think that we should and people who think, you know what, these, you know, our job is to go in and kill bad guys and detain bad guys. And that's what we're there to do. So, you know, throughout this whole period that we've been in, and I don't think it's going away anytime soon, there's an argument within the Army about whether we should even be engaging in things like this that aren't straight, you know, what the military calls kinetic fighting missions.
But, you know, you give two examples in your book that certainly struck me. One concerned situations in Iraq, for instance, where there were a number of roadblocks that were set up, and typically a GI would be there, and if traffic was coming, he'd put his arm out, extend his arm, meaning stop. But to the Iraqis, that meant welcome. And so they'd continue driving. And then what would happen? They'd get blown away. The other one was concerned weddings in Afghanistan, where typically after a wedding ceremony, they'd shoot. There are many guns. Everybody has guns in Afghanistan. They'd shoot guns in the air in celebration. If a helicopter happened to be nearby thinking it was taking fire, it'd fire on the crowd at the wedding.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And those are just two examples of like really, to me, tragic and meaningless, you know, violence, you know, directed from Americans who didn't know what was going on. And you know, often, you know, civilians in Afghanistan and Iraq paying the price for that. And it's really, you know, I think that we didn't, I don't believe we went into Afghanistan and Iraq because we wanted to occupy those countries forever and we wanted to turn them into our colonies. But I think we have to get our mind around the fact that people in those places, you know, when soldiers come in with guns, not speaking your language. I mean, imagine what it would be like here if a foreign army marched into our country, you know, not speaking English, carrying weapons. I mean, you know, I'll tell you what, if some of the people who are serving over in Afghanistan who I've talked to, those would be the first people who would be fighting back against any kind of a force that came in, even if the force that was here on our soil was saying, oh, we want to make your life better. I mean, you know, Afghans are very skeptical of that.
Be specific as you can be with regard to how these teams would affect or impact the kind of situations I just described. I mean, they would know. Theoretically, they would know that the guns are going to be fired after a wedding, and they would know what the gesture meant at the roadblock. How do they get that information to the troops? How do they deal with it?
Right. So the idea of this whole of this program was that in situations like that, what soldiers really need is, as one of the creators of the program put it, an angel on their shoulder, somebody who really understands the place, right there with them, saying, that guy who's talking to you right now, he's not saying I hate America, and he's not yelling at you. He's his voice is raised because he's scared that you're going to shoot him, and so you need to back down and you need to just realize this guy, you know, you're not understanding him. Or in the case of the roadblocks, you know, to advise soldiers that this gesture that you think everybody understands. I mean, there was a case of this in Iraq where just exactly what you described happened, and it was either a Marine or a soldier who had been at the checkpoint said, well, you know, stop. It's the international language. Everybody understands it. Well, you know, sorry, it's not the international language. You know, they don't have the same road signs that we do. They don't speak the same language. It's crazy to think that they would.
Right. Let's go to the phones. We have a number of calls, Vanessa, and I'd like to get the audience into it as quickly as possible. And we'll start with Larry. Larry, thanks for being with us. Go ahead.
I welcome your guest, and I'm really looking forward to reading your book. I was a social scientist over in a team in Helmand Province and just got back last July. And I guess the only comment that I would like to make is that I hope that you and your guest and our listeners understand that there are a lot of people that gave up full-time jobs to enter this. I had some friends whose children were hurt over in Afghanistan as being a result of being in the military. And one of our jobs really was to help try to reduce things like IEDs and ambushes. And we really went over there, and I think the military had a good idea to try to understand the population a little better. Whether we were always successful, I'm not really sure that that's the case, but I think there were a lot of people that really poured their heart and soul into this. And I hope that your listeners understand that.
Yeah, I really appreciate the call, and I'd love to know, Larry, are you still with us? Where were you in Helmand?
I was at Camp Leatherneck.
Okay, well, I spent some time with a team there, so
it's in the book.
Yeah,
I'm going to read it.
Well, thanks. That's an interesting part of Afghanistan. I think you're absolutely right. So, what I want to be really clear about this that you know, a lot of people made a lot of sacrifices in Afghanistan over the last more than 10 years that we've been there. I'm talking about soldiers, Marines, civilians, people from the State Department, USAID, and folks from the human terrain system. You know, I absolutely agree with the caller. These people had, many of them, the best of intentions. My concern is that we need to be thinking systematically about how to solve these problems before we're in the middle of a war. And, I think a lot of the problems that happened with the human terrain system, and I don't want to suggest at all that there weren't any good things that the program achieved, because I think there were. But the problems with it had to do with a lack of forethought, an abundance of ambition by some of the people who created it, and, just like the difficulty of putting something so complicated into effect in the midst of two wars.
And the final comment that I'd like to make is, being with the Marines over there, I cannot say enough good about the Marines. They were trusted over there. They did what they said what they mean, and the locals really trusted them. And that was really one of our objectives, is to see how things were going and how things were being taken by the population, at least in the time that I was over there, which was the end of 2011 and part of 2012. So thank you for taking my call.
Thank you.
Thank you for calling. We should tell Larry that in one paragraph in your book, you point out that the Marines actually, in some cases, did a much better job of dealing with this than their Army counterparts did.
Yeah, I was really impressed with the Marines I spent time with in Helmand. And, that's where they were concentrated and still are in Afghanistan. The Marines have a history, unlike the Army, of doing small wars and being involved with different kinds of intelligence, including cultural intelligence. And they tended to have, in my experience, just a much better vibe for talking to people. A lot of more of them had studied the local languages. A lot more of them were led by commanders who really understood how important it was to get to know people in those areas. So I completely agree with the caller on that.
You've just made the man behind you, who is engineering this program, very happy. Jeremy Bailey is an ex-Marine. He's very happy about that. And another part of this story, before I go back to the phones, is the fact that I have it as a list of failings of the program that I put down. Is the fact that these people were selected by contractors. They were run by contractors and paid by contractors. Why?
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And, that's the way we do business now, especially when we're in the middle of a war. That's the way the government increasingly does business. I mean, we have really cut dramatically the number of people who actually work for the government who are working over in war zones. And I'm talking about not just this program, but people who work for the U.S. Agency for International Development, people who even work for the it's a little different with the State Department. But, to be frank, a lot of these people are contractors, and the human terrain system was no different. And there were very few. There was very little oversight on this contract. So you had a big contracting company called BAE Systems, and they were hiring people, without face-to-face interviews, with very little knowledge of what these people's real qualifications were, and sending them over to Afghanistan and Iraq. And actually the people who ran the program on the granular level, the guy who was the program manager was outraged by the people who he was being sent by the contractor, but there was nothing he could do about it because that was the way the government does business.
In fairness, we have to point out that the motivation for people who had signed up for the program was money. They were making as much as $300,000 a year.
Yeah, initially. So in the period of the program that my book focuses on, which is the early years of it, you know, that's changed now. So now they're paid like they're counted as Department of Army civilians, and they're paid like government employees. So they're not making quite as much money anymore. But you know, initially that was a big motivation for people. I would not say it was the only motivation, but it was a big one. I mean, you just can't ignore the fact that $350,000 is a lot of money for anybody who's a social scientist.
Sure. And a lot of the people who were on that pay scale quit when the pay system was changed.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right.
Back to the phones. Let's bring in Patrick. Patrick, thanks for waiting. Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call, Don, and thanks for your guests and our work. I spent time in Afghanistan on two different occasions, and the points that I want to bring up have to do with the media blackout that's happened in this country since 2010, where we just don't hear about what's happening even inside the war, the one war that people will acknowledge. Add to that the fact that we're fighting more than one war if you take into account the drug wars that are going on throughout the country, and everybody's just listed as AOG, Armed Opposition Groups. They're all lumped together as though the Taliban is attacking every time, when in reality it's much more complicated than that. And together with that, the U.S. military has blacked out major media for soldiers to look at, soldiers and Marines, because of WikiLeaks and because of classified so-called information being released by these news sources, so that our force of infantry and everybody going over there is misinformed at best.
Can I ask, are you in the military?
No.
Okay. Well, I think that's a great you have a great sense of what's going on over there, it sounds like. I mean, one of the things I always tell people about Afghanistan is the bombs that you read about going off, the violence that you hear about, it's not always about the Taliban versus the U.S. There's a lot going on over there. There are a lot of bad actors, you know, drug dealers, corrupt politicians, you know, common criminals who take advantage of the instability of the system to further their own ends. And so there's a lot of violence that happens in Afghanistan that, you know, isn't about, you know, this ideological battle between the Taliban and the Americans. And that's something that's really so important for soldiers and Marines, but also for regular Americans to understand about the war. It's a very, very complicated picture. I can't speak directly to the media blackout, but I think what I can say is that, you know, my profession, journalism, is not in the greatest moment right now. The internet is giving us a lot of fits, and it's eaten our lunch, and we're trying to figure out how to actually have resources to cover important international stories. And, you know, we're not at the moment figuring that out well enough. And I think the coverage of the war in Afghanistan has really suffered for that and a whole number of other reasons. But I also think that people have really tuned out a lot from this war. And I guess one thing I do want to say is that if you've ever asked the question, you know, what are we doing over there? What is this place? Who are these people? You know, I think that perhaps my book might help explain some of that. It's really, I don't want people to be scared off by this topic.
Part of the reason go ahead.
I'm sorry. I appreciate that. You know, I was able to teach school in Kabul and get to know people from provinces, you know, far and wide, and travel around and actually, you know, get to know people in their, you know, on their terms. And I just think that there's so little of that anywhere in the U.S. government, from the State Department throughout the military and on down. But in terms of the media blackout, it's definitely happening. There's absolutely a stranglehold on journalists in that country in terms of, if you report what you see and not what we dole out as today's rhetoric, you're not going to work here and you're not going to work anywhere. And I know that for sure. Now, together with that, what I would like to see from the journalism here in the country is to separate how much money are we spending on a drug war in Helmand compared with the Taliban, you know, cataclysm. And, you know, if we can separate those things and really look.
I guess we lost him.
Those are great points. And this is a, you know, this caller has had some really interesting experience of living actually in Afghanistan, not on a military base. I mean, he's teaching in Kabul. That's a great way to see the country that a lot of soldiers and Marines never get to see even a sliver of. I guess I would just say that in my experience of reporting in Afghanistan for all these years, you know, I think the caller is right when it comes to reporting in the military context. So what many listeners may not know is that most of the reporting that we get from a place like Afghanistan or Iraq during the war was done by embedded journalists. Those are people who have signed up with the military and they're embedded with a military unit. You eat, you sleep, you travel with that unit. You know, that reporting, I wouldn't say it's controlled by the military exactly, but there certainly are there's self-censorship that goes on because, you know, you don't want to – you can get thrown out of the unit you're with. I mean, it causes a lot of problems for your story if you write very critical things. Not to say that people haven't. I mean, you know, General McChrystal, who was a commander there, lost his job because of what an embedded reporter wrote about him. So it's certainly, you know, and I've written things and others have too. But I would just also say that when you're out in the country in Afghanistan, in Kabul or out and around talking to Afghans, there's nobody who's controlling what you're doing. I mean, you're free to do what you want.
You mentioned the people in this country tuning out. To a large degree, it's because they're not getting a lot of reporting out of Afghanistan, but also because they don't have a direct connection. There's not that many families that have people in that part of the world who are doing the fighting, so they kind of shrug their shoulders.
Well, that's absolutely right, and, you know, it's a consequence of having a volunteer military that we, you know, because we no longer have a draft, and, you know, we can debate until the end of time whether that was a good move or a bad move in the aftermath of the Vietnam War. I think most people think that was a positive move. We certainly have a more professional military because of it. But, you know, what it means is that, yeah, that we have people who make a choice to fight. Every family doesn't feel this. And, you know, and that makes a big difference in who's involved in the conversation.
That's Vanessa Ghazari, author of The Tender Soldier, A True Story of War and Sacrifice. We're talking about her time in Afghanistan and Iraq, and also about a program that the government and the military has been waging over there to win the hearts and minds of the people, but apparently not very effectively. Back to continue our conversation, take more of your calls in just a moment. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Hello again. Welcome back to our conversation with the journalist, author Vanessa Ghazari. I'm going to go right to the phones of Vanessa and bring in Kristen, who's been waiting patiently in Imperial, Missouri. Go ahead, Kristen.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm just curious as to if the program isn't working as well as I would hope that it would, because I think finding out information about what these people or how they've lived before we were there is important to helping them rebuild their country after we leave. But I think that the tie with the military is really hurting because, as from a biology perspective, it's difficult to understand complex social patterns in any other environment other than an organism's natural environment. And when you add something like the military, which is going to, you know, stress these people out, whether they're good or bad, it's frightening to have people with guns and tanks and stuff in your home. And do you think that aspect of the program is or could be what is hindering its progress?
Yeah, great point that you make, Kristen. So I think there's a couple things going on there. One is that during a war, things get very complicated and cultures get more complicated by what is happening in the conflict. And so to try to study a culture in the middle of a war is adding a layer of complexity and difficulty and changing people's behavior. I mean, war changes the way people act, the way they live. So you're not really seeing, as you say, a picture of people in their natural habitat. You're seeing a picture of people struggling in the midst of conflict and adapting to conflict and trying to stay alive. So it's sort of an odd time to try to study people and figure out what they're like. But, you know, you're absolutely right, too, that we see our military as a force for good in the world. We see our armed men and women as good young Americans who are going out and making sacrifices to try to make things better in a place like Afghanistan. And I think, you know, that's valid from our perspective. But a lot of people don't realize just exactly what you say, that Afghans, you know, when they see people coming into their country, into their backyard, into their house, who are armed, who don't speak their language, That is a really, really terrifying thing. And I think what you get at is the fact that our military is doing a kind of, you know, it's doing aid work, development work, making foreign policy on the ground in Afghanistan. And actually, maybe it shouldn't be the military who's doing that. Maybe it should be civilians.
Thanks for the call, Kristen. You know, you point out, you pointed out earlier in the program that these folks are trained and are, some have been sent over, well, I have a note here, to Iraq. They were learned nothing of Iraqi culture or the of the people, and yet they were still sent over here. They're trained for 5 months. Is that correct? Am I remembering that correctly? Training for these teams.
Yeah, and you know, I have to say that again, you know, the period that the book is about, things have changed some with the program since then. So, but yes, at the time that I was writing about in the and you know, the training was 5 months, and I think it's a little shorter now, but the training cycle has also changed a lot. The one question I really tried to get to the bottom of, and I couldn't I couldn't entirely, because I didn't spend the entire 5 months with them, was like what they spent that 5 months doing. I mean, because, you know, I was able to visit some of the training, and there was a, you know, there was a limit to what the military would let me see of that. But, you know, I then was out in the field with people who had done this training and who, you know, didn't know the difference between, you know, a Pashtun and a Hazara. You know, these are two of the major ethnic groups in Afghanistan. And if you know nothing else about Afghanistan, you know that there are several major ethnic groups and they don't get along very well. So, I mean, the fact that this person with the human terrain system didn't even know that really made me question what the training was all about.
Well, what is the program like today?
You know, I think some of the most obvious problems with the program have been corrected or addressed, at least. One of those has to do with the way that team members are hired. The contractor who was involved in the hiring at the beginning is no longer involved. There's a new contractor now. There's still millions of dollars being poured into the program, but that contractor seems to be doing a more careful job hiring people. So, for example, there are face-to-face interviews now. There's a physical fitness test now for people who are going to join this program. I mean, you can't send somebody out into combat, a civilian, who's not able to, you know, wear 50 pounds of gear, wear body armor, and go out and run 3 miles. I mean, you can't do that. And that's what they were doing.
We have a caller who couldn't stay, and I'm trying to sort through exactly what the point is here. Pat says that he was a developer for Human Terrain in 2003 and wants to know if her book talks about the bigger issues regarding human terrain objectives. I'm not sure there. Was it even in effect in 2003? I thought it was more like 2007 that this whole thing got started.
Yeah, well, 2007 was when the program sent its first team to Afghanistan. Okay. So, but the development did start earlier, and I'd be very interested to talk to that caller, because 2003 is early for this, but there were certainly people in all corners of the Pentagon thinking about this problem in 2003.
Well, maybe Pat can call back and leave a number or an email address or something that you can have contact with him or her. Back to the phones. The longest person waiting in line is Jerry calling from O'Fallon. Jerry, thanks for waiting so long. Go ahead.
Well, good morning. Thank you. You've made most of my points already, but I, in teaching and learning about security a few decades ago, there is this American sense of hubris that we seem to think we can go into any situation. As you said, we're seen by the natives, you know, the people who live there. This is their country. We're the invaders. And people struggle on the in the big picture to understand, say, acts of terrorism. And, you know, there's hours we could talk about this, but to put it very succinctly, from a person I work with, an ex-Marine counterterrorism specialist, who, as he very briefly and bluntly and directly explained it, he said, you have to understand that every terrorist is someone else's freedom fighter. And I don't think we've reached that level of understanding when we go into situations like this.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely right. And, you know, I think it's much easier when we're here in the United States, and particularly at a time when we've been attacked, like in the days after September 11th. I mean, that was a terrible time in this country. And it's just easier to see these people as nothing like us, and people who want to kill us, and people who hate us because of our freedoms. Those are all things that were said and maybe are still said by people now. But it's a lot more complicated than that. One of the things I try to do in this book, and it was a difficult journal journalistic undertaking and difficult on the heart, actually, was that, you know, we talked a little bit about the act of violence that's with which the book begins. You know, I really spent a lot of time in Afghanistan over the last couple of years trying to figure out who this guy was who attacked Paula Lloyd and why he did it. And that was something that was just written off by people. People said he's a Taliban guy. He hates us. He hates Americans. That's why he did it. Well, you know, it turned out to be a lot more complicated than that. And I think people will find some surprising twists and turns in this story.
I think I'm just trying to think Jerry's comment there with regard to one man's terrorist as another man's freedom fighter. I think Menachem Begin, a former prime minister of Israel, made that comment because he was both, actually, in his lifetime. Back to the phones. Dennis in University City, thank you for waiting. Go ahead.
Hi. Wonderful discussion. I come from the perspective of working in the Marine area in Tua Tien Hue province in Vietnam during 67 and 68, in a pretty memorable time.
Ooh.
And the Marines, USMC, was involved in CAP, Combined Action Patrols. This can be learned by reading a book by McManus, a gentleman named McManus at University of Missouri Science and Technology. It's called Grunts. And that's point A. They were successful, but Mr. Westmoreland, and nobody wants to know the real facts about that guy, Mr. Westmoreland wanted to search and destroy while the Marines were having quite a bit of success with their combined action platoons. And the author here, and I will get the book and read it, good follow-up on Dupree on Afghanistan. Anyway, the programs of the Marines, and as she says, it's exactly been a Marine tradition for many years, sometimes for the better, sometimes for the worse. Now, there are also some other quickies I'd like to recommend.
Please make it quick.
Thomas Ricks, The Generals, people should read. And they should read Chalmers Johnson, Blowback, The Agony of Empire, and Nemesis, because those are big picture books, and they tell us why there are so many terrorists. And as the author says, and the caller, one of the previous callers says about a news blackout, indeed, and when I was in Vietnam, I saw things that we weren't supposed to talk about, and Daniel Ellsberg had quite a time revealing them.
Dennis, thank you so much for the call. We have other callers waiting, but we appreciate your comments. Let's go to Glenda calling from Washington, Missouri. Go ahead, Glenda.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Yes. I was wondering if your guest had ever read the book In Her Father's Country by Saima Wahab.
I have not, actually. No, I haven't.
Well, she was actually, I heard about it on NPR on this station, and it's a true account. She's one of the, she was an Army interpreter, and she was born and raised in Afghanistan, but came to the United States for her education, and then joined the part of the Army that translates, one of the only translators in the whole United States for this particular language of this group in Afghanistan. And I would advise everybody to read this book. It is so fascinating because she actually is from this Afghanistan, and she can get in and talk to the people where many times they don't trust anybody. But when she would speak their language, they automatically let her in and share stuff with her that they wouldn't with anybody else. But it's a wonderful true story account of her.
Glenda, thank you so much for the call. You know, you're appearing tonight at the St. Louis County Library at 7 o'clock. We want to point out that folks can have more of what we've been talking about at that time. You also have a complete list of books that you can check out at the library, thanks to our last two callers. You know, one of the things that we've been hearing a lot about lately, Vanessa, has been that these Afghanis that we've been training have been turning on their trainers. There have been a number of incidents where our troops have been killed. What is going on there? I mean, does this represent obviously a failure on the part of the kind of projects we've been talking about?
In part, yes. I mean, these are – so these insider attacks were a real big problem. You know, I think they were really at their height in 2011, 2012. Mm-hmm. It seems like we're not hearing as much about them now. But, yeah, I think this is not purely a cultural knowledge problem, though, to be fair. This is a problem of the Taliban having gained a lot of strength and being able to infiltrate the new Afghan armed forces as well. And, you know, so there's various things going on. Some of the folks who are attacking American soldiers have been planted there, and they really didn't, you know, it turns out there aren't such great controls. There's a lot of corruption in the new Afghan army, and it's not, you know, they don't do such a great job of checking some of these people out. It's also a very difficult job to be an Afghan soldier at this moment when the army is just in its infancy. It's remaking there, and, you know, there aren't a lot of resources, and these a lot of these folks who are joining up don't have a lot of choices. So there's that. But there's certainly also an element of cultural disconnect. I mean, things that in Afghanistan, I've experienced this myself, you know, there are certain kinds of things that offend people in Afghanistan that you just can't say. You know, you don't confront people directly there. That's not done. It's not – you don't go to somebody and say, hey, you did this wrong. That's something that, you know, you might say, that American soldiers might say, or a commander might say to one of his soldiers that, you know, you did this wrong. You need to do this way. Mm-hmm. If you say that to an Afghan, it's like you've insulted his pride. You've insulted his family, his background. And I don't want to generalize because Afghans are all different from each other. But, you know, culturally, that's not done. There's a much more indirect way of communicating. And we don't communicate that way.
Until someone threw a shoe at then President George Bush, who would have known that showing the sole of your foot to some of these people was a grave insult?
Absolutely.
A grave insult. When was the last time you were there in Afghanistan, Vanessa?
I was there last in 2010, very end of 2010.
Do you have any sense, and of course none of us is prescient and can't project into the future, but you hear it said and suggested a lot that once we're out of there, this country and others are going to just revert back to what they were before all of this happened.
Yeah, I mean, I would say I'm not terribly optimistic about what's going to happen when we're out of there. We have managed to give the Afghans some breathing space this last 10 years in terms of, you know, putting in a government that, for all its problems, has not been too terribly repressive to the large number of people, at least not in the same way the Taliban were. Different groups, ethnic groups and women have gained some new rights. There's been a huge space opened up in Afghanistan for the press. Actually, Afghan journalism is one of the success stories of this war. There are, there's a whole proliferation of Afghans out there telling the stories of their own country. There's you know, great big Afghan TV stations with dramas and comedies. So this is culturally, there's been kind of this explosion and vibrancy during this time, and a lot of education that we have enabled and the international community has enabled. The other side of that is that all this time, all these guys who were the leaders during the Mujahideen era in the fight against the Russians, you know, when we were in the Cold War, those guys are essentially political and militia leaders who we have again supported during this war, but who are, you know, viewed by many Afghans as war criminals. These are people who killed a lot of Afghans during the Afghan Civil War. And during the last 10 years, those people have only increased their power and prominence under our watch. And when we leave, they're going to be jockeying for power again. So that's why people say what they do about Afghanistan going to war after we leave.
A little less than a minute left, and now we're hearing talks about negotiations taking place in Qatar, I believe, between the Karzai government and Taliban representatives. At least they're trying to get together, from what I understand. What does that bode?
Yeah, hard to tell at this point. I mean, I think that that's something that has needed to happen for a long time. And there have been many efforts over the years, probably ones that people don't really know about here, to talk to the Taliban. I really hope that we and the Afghan government, and really it's more about the Afghan government than it is about us, can find a way to talk to these guys. I don't like their beliefs any better than anyone else does, but, you know, they are part of the picture over there.
Right. Well, that's Vanessa Ghazari. She is the author of the book, The Tender Soldier, A True Story of War and Sacrifice. It's a good read. I certainly enjoyed it. And thanks again, Vanessa, for being with us. And if you'd like more, tonight at 7 o'clock at the St. Louis County Library headquarters on Lindbergh, just a little bit south of Highway 40, she'll be there at 7 o'clock. Vanessa, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Tomorrow on St. Louis on the Air, we'll talk with Charlie Miller, an internationally renowned ethical hacker who lives in Wildwood, Missouri. The former NSA worker now works for Twitter, and we'll talk to him about privacy and the implications of cyber warfare in the ever-growing digital age. A web feature is now on the front page of our website about the Great Flood of 93. We've gone back through our archives some 20 years after the flood and have stories about the water's rise and the tension that engulfed the region during that period. Visit stlpublicradio.org and share your experiences about the flood on our Facebook and Twitter pages. We may use your comments for an upcoming edition of St. Louis on the Air. Archive versions of past St. Louis on the Air programs are available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org. St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio, 90.7 KWMU. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Don Marsh.